Our speaker this morning is Gregory Wilson. He's going to speak on love and community.
Well, good morning. Several of you have asked me why the Band-Aid on my face, and I've postponed telling that story until now. I've been having dreams this past month about starting at track meets, and I'd hem-haul around the line, and I wouldn't start, and then I'd start, and there'd be false starts, and I'd said, nah, these dreams don't mean anything. You know, it's just a dream. Well, the other day I was working on my car and changing my starter, and the starter fell on my face. So I thought, God's wanting me to pay attention to starting something, and he had to drop a starter on my face to get me to do it. So whatever I start in the near future, we better pay attention, because starters are falling. It's not a pleasant experience. Anytime we speak of love, I think in today's culture, we tread on the ground of the superficial, or we hear words that we like to hear, but they don't really contain the meaning and the substance of changing our lives. And we seem to roll right along in life. And today, when I read the stories of Buddha and the story of Jesus, one thing I know for sure is that love considered for its fullness and for the weight of what it is, we change when we experience love. Things are different. They are not the same. And so that when we're committed to love, or that we love a partner, that we love our children, that we love our church, that we love one another, but yet there's no movement in unity, and there's no movement to greater kindness, and there's no movement to greater commitment, then I may understand love, but I've yet to experience love. And whenever you read theologians who talk about God and who talk about love and things, they have a tendency to complicate things, because they drive us right to the point of information and ideas and concepts. For example, if you read the theologian James Luther Adams, one of the main theologians of Unitarian Universalism in the 20th century, and or the theologian Paul Tillich, when they talk about love, they don't talk about love outside of justice, power, and unity. You can't separate love outside of justice and power. They talk about love is the fabric of existence, of the fabric of life, and as we are, and as we are in a state of being, that love moves us to become other than that which we were. Love changes us. We become other than that which we were, which we are. Love is a driving force toward unity. Then that's confrontive to me, because then I'll ask the question, does my behavior, does my encounters, do my conversations, do my evaluations of politics lead to unity or division? Does my internal dialogue with myself lead to love, compassion, and unity? Or do I stay in a separate, fragmented place within myself? The theologian Paul Tillich, he said the first duty of love is to listen. The first duty of love is to listen. The first duty of love is to pay attention to the other. The first duty of love. He also says that there is no love which does not become help. I thought that was rather simple. But then if I find myself in a place where I'm not in the process of serving in a community, serving one another, helping myself, helping others, is there an absence of love in my life? Is that a way to gauge? Then both Tillich and James Luther Adams talk about religion and love, and they say the first movement of religion and the first movement of the aspect of love as we consider religion is that religion is a state of being grasped. Religion is a state of all of my imagination, all of who I am as a human being, for somehow in some way is centralized and grasped by something other than who I am. Now how can that be? To be grasped by something other than who I am. If I don't believe in other than who I am. How many of you have ever been grasped by love and you're bewildered for the next 4 or 5 days? Hopefully, bewildered for 50 years. Because love has the power to do that. But if love isn't intertwined with justice and power, love of objects, love of others can certainly become destructive. What I'd like to share today in some detail about the Buddhism and about Christianity, I don't think can really be understood unless we understand the context in which Buddhism and Christianity emerged. When the Apostle Paul, in writing a letter to the community in Rome, says, "Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind," how are we to understand that if we don't understand what world he's talking about? Be not conformed to this world. If we don't know what this world is about, how do I know whether I'm conformed to it or not conformed to it? I don't know unless I have some understanding of that. When Siddhartha, who became Buddha, when he left his position as the son of the king to become king, when he realized that within his kingdom he wasn't going to be able to accomplish being compassionate to the people of his kingdom, he left his kingdom. Unless I understand his reasoning for him leaving his kingdom, and even the king didn't have the power to implement compassion to the citizens of the kingdom, unless I understand the nature of that kingdom, how am I to understand why he had to leave the kingdom to implement his spirituality and develop his path to enlightenment? Unless I understand what would prohibit the emergence and the becoming of love expressing itself in the community that Buddha was going to be king of. The world that Buddha lived in and the world that Jesus lived in were problematic worlds. And in this way, I'd like to share just briefly some of the characteristics of those worlds so that we can have a better understanding of why they chose the spiritual path they did, and also not to lose the value of their teaching because we don't understand the world that they live in. In Unitarian Universalism, there is on some parts, mine, others, that we have a tendency to dismiss some spiritual and religious teachings because they don't make sense to us in our modern world. That's a problem. And I think we do that because we don't pay attention to the world in which these teachings emerged from. And in order to understand the world 500 BC, or understand the world that Jesus was born into, we have to understand this. That was a world in which, as oddly as it may seem to some of us, that overcrowding was a problem. Population control was a problem. Before the birth of Christ, 5,000 years before the birth of Christ, problems began to emerge. And these problems were something like this, if some of you remember your world history. For the first time, there were standing armies. Armies did not exist forever. There was a time when we did not have armies. But for the first time, there were standing armies. Signs of war, signs of distress. No one was writing books and no one was writing history about the slums of the cities and the political and the corruption that was emerging 4,000, 5,000 years before the birth of Christ. Crime was emerging as a problem. Crime didn't always exist. It was emerging as a problem because of overpopulation. Not only did these problems begin to emerge, here's what I think I find confusing when I read it, but then when I look at my own world, I see it. There was, for the first time, political and military adventurism became normal. Not only was that normalized, but it became a value. To have the strongest standing army, to have the technology to conquer other peoples, became a high value. It was a sign of distress over what was happening in a culture, and at the same time, it becomes a high value. Counterfeiting, inflation, famine, plagues, poor sanitary conditions. Slavery became an international business. And it was during this time that something called the salvationist religions that emerged, people began to think that there was something wrong with them. Have you ever been in a situation, in a relationship, whether child or adult, which things were going wrong, and you began to think it was you? You began to blame yourself. You began to think, what's wrong with me that I find myself in this difficult position? And you begin to put it on who you are as a human being. I think it's a natural tendency for human beings when they're in a situation and we can't figure out our way out of the situation, we move in the direction where we blame ourselves. I think it's on.
Hang on.
See, it's what happened when a starter hits you in the face. You think off is on and on is off. Okay. So when Buddha began to evaluate the kingdom that he was going to inherit, and he began to evaluate whether he was going to be able to implement the policies as king that he was going to inherit, he came to the conclusion that he was not going to be able to do that. He came to the conclusion that he was going to have to leave his kingdom and abandon his birthright in order to pursue his spiritual path, which ultimately led to Buddhism. He was got married, and then he was taking a tour of his future kingdom and was with his wife. And he began to show her poverty, disease, the effects of the way of life that I had described. Her response, if you can read this in the book, a story about the development of compassion, her response was to build social programs and become politically active. I said, now there may be the birth of Unitarian Universalism, I don't know. But then, that was her response. His response was, I'm not going to be able to change this, which I think is crucial to understand. Even a person who is put in charge of a system, if that system is so corrupt and so entrenched, that person's not going to be able to change the system by themselves. As king, he couldn't do it because he didn't have the infrastructure that would facilitate transformation. And I think for our day, that's a message that we need to hear. So he left his kingdom. And he went out into the woods and he began a path to deal with the way the world was. Overcrowded, oppression, tyranny, slavery. Horrible, horrible ways of existence. And he met a teacher. And here's the important aspect about spirituality about being grasped. And I think this gets us to the place about being grasped. What religion is about being grasped by something other than who you are. Because who we are, we develop in this culture. When the Apostle Paul says, don't be conformed to this world, the first given is that we are conformed to this world. That's the first given. We are conformed to the world we are born in. We cannot escape that. We cannot get around it. That's just true. That when my father worked down the plant and my mother stayed at home and he's working double shifts and he's involved in a union and I'm watching that conflict, that's coming inside of me and that becomes part of who I am. Good or bad, it doesn't matter. They go through a divorce. Our family goes through trauma. It comes inside of me. It's part of who I am, and it's also part of the larger culture. It's just who I am. So when Buddha meets his first teacher outside of his culture, the teacher has to teach him how to breathe first. He didn't even know how to breathe. He had to teach him how to breathe to move inward. Then the teacher teaches him that he's got to let go of the past and let go of the future. And these are the first teachings he has. Then his teacher teaches him he's got to let go of mental constructs. When I first read that, I thought, what is that? He's got to let go of that. Then he's got to learn that everything is an illusion. I was listening to the politicians talk, and they said the 20th century regulatory process doesn't match the 21st century economic system. And then I read this, that we've got to let go of the illusion. And I thought, oh, that's an illusion. It's all created. It's not real. And that was what Buddha was discovering. That everything that he had learned, everything he had conformed to, his spiritual teacher was teaching him, they're illusions. They're not real. And in order for you to discover your truest self, you've got to let go of those and become other than that to which you were conformed to. And as Buddha does that and spends years meditating and following his teacher's teaching to become a teacher himself, when he gets down to the center of who he is, what he discovers is a sense of compassion. When he can let go of his world, when he can let go of how he was conformed, what he discovers is a sense of compassion for himself, and then begins to develop a spiritual practice that leads others to compassion and helps him stay in a state of compassion. So Douglas Adams, and what's the title of the book Douglas Adams wrote? The Woodpecker. Tom Robbins. Yes. In the very beginning of that book, he talks about the important questions. And one of the important questions was, should I kill myself or not kill myself in the philosophy of humanity? And think about that being an important question. He says, no, that's not the important question. He said, the important question is this. How do we maintain the sense of love as we go through time? And he says, if you can answer me that, then I can help you with the first question. Right? How do we maintain that? Well, that's what the Buddha taught. His practice was maintaining a sense of compassion through time. That's also what the Apostle Paul was teaching. That we can maintain an attitude of love through time. And the process the Apostle Paul talks about, being not conformed to this world, but being transformed by the renewing of your mind out of the teachings and the life of the prophet Jesus. And what he was saying was this, and I think this is where we get lost in the teachings of Jesus when we determine whether they make sense to us or whether they don't make sense to us. Because as the Apostle Paul talks about that, he talks about it in the death and the resurrection of Jesus. This is the way out of being conformed to this world. You have to be grasped by the resurrected Jesus. You have to be grasped by that sense of love that somebody would sacrifice their life for you. You have to be grasped by that, and you begin from there. And that's what the Apostle Paul is talking about. It's different from what Buddha was talking about. Buddha was talking about a process of letting go of conformity. The Apostle Paul's talking about you have to be grasped by it, and I'm trying to understand why are they different. They lead to the similar and same places, but why are they different? And I was thinking, well, Buddha's 500-600 years before Jesus. And in the world of Buddha, when he went out and found a teacher, that was the point. He could go out and find a teacher that he could be taught by. There were communities around. The kingdoms in his world, there's a kingdom here. There's a kingdom here. There's a kingdom here. There's space in between the kingdoms. And in the space in between the kingdoms, you find these religious communities working on and trying to understand the ailments of what it means to be human, living in a culture that's overcrowded with all the ailments that come with that process that I read earlier. But in Jesus' time, that's not the same. It's different. There's an empire that sweeps the globe in Jesus' time. There were laws you can't start new religions. In his time, you would be crucified, you would be killed if you started a new religion under this empire that swept the world. That's the difference. So when the Apostle Paul talks about there must be a death and a resurrection, and then the emphasis moves from this life to another life, it's because there's nowhere else to go. And he says in all earnest, we need to spread this message because here's a way for us to let go of that which burdens us because we live in a society that cripples us spiritually, and you've got to be grasped by the love of somebody willing to sacrifice their life to help you. And when you can feel that love of somebody sacrificing their life, you can let go of this life and you can engage in a new life. And he goes on further to say that we are no longer human beings, we no longer see from the human viewpoint at that particular time. We see a viewpoint from the work and the ministry of Jesus. And when we see that viewpoint, we see a viewpoint from total and a pure sense of love. And I'm trying to understand this pure sense of love that Paul's talking about at this point. So I was working on that, and so I made up this exercise that you can do in 30 seconds, which I'm going to ask you to do, that when you stand in the center of your own universe and your imagination and you look around at your history today, this morning, yesterday, maybe particularly the election, and prior, when you stand there and you look at your history and you look at the recent events, are there things in your mind that pull you away from the sense of love? Are there faces, are there memories in your mind that pull you away from the sense of compassion toward yourself and others? Are there memories, are there experiences, are there images, are there faces that as you look in your mind that shift you away from the sense of love that the Apostle Paul is talking about? Well, intellectually, I said, yeah, that sounds like a good thing to do. But then I did it. I've got hundreds of memories and hundreds of images in my mind that when I look at it, it pulls me away from the sense of compassion and sense of love. As a matter of fact, I can call up memories and images in my mind that move me right to a state of rage and state of hate if I'm not careful. I think that's what both the Buddha and the Jesus and the Apostle Paul is talking about, that we are grasped by something that moves us to a place where no memory, no sense of the future, no event in here and now can move me away from the sense of compassion, the sense of love that these religious leaders were talking about. The Apostle Paul goes one to further and says that those who follow the teachings of Jesus are ambassadors of this message that you can live outside of the tyranny of your culture. So they go to the other world. Today, if we are followers of the teachings of Jesus, as Paul There is no sweeping empire that oppresses us that we have no other place to go. Today, if I were going to translate that passage from the Apostle Paul, it's not that we would be ambassadors to bring the message that we can let go of the burdens of this world because in the next world things are going to be okay. I don't have to live in that dissociated state. We would be ambassadors of the messages of love and compassion and justice and power because we live in a culture that has civil liberties where we can still do that. If the Apostle Paul were writing in a culture where there were civil liberties, the emphasis would be on social justice, not the next life. So we become ambassadors of a message of compassion and love because we are grasped by a spirit of compassion and love. And when we are grasped by that spirit, we do become the ambassadors of a sense of justice, of a sense of love, of a sense of peace to the culture that we are in. We are, as Unitarian Universalists, ambassadors of that message of love and justice and power, and they need to be intertwined to bring unity to our whole community and not isolate some or marginalize some or scapegoat some so we can feel good about ourselves and maintain our own power. That's who we are as Unitarian Universalists. We do carry the message, not just of Buddha, but of his wife who began the political and social programs to deal with the poor and poverty and marginalized. We carry that message. We carry that message when Jesus talks about don't lay your treasures up in heaven, but love one another and care for one another. And you will know, Jesus says, you will know that you're followers of my teaching because you love one another. And then we listen to the theologians of today and they says, well, if you love one another, to love one another means it ends up in an attitude of helping one another. We are the ambassadors of the messages of compassion and love and justice and power. And it's my wish that we could feel that and continue to act that way in our community.